This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Marzalek, a host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, a LGBTQ+ studies channel podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking to Elizabeth McCain about her new book, A Lesbian Belle Tells, Outrageous Southern Stories of Family, Loss, and Love. Settle back for a wild ride through a Southern lesbian's life of soul-searching, rule-breaking, and truth-telling. This Belle's kind of coming out was not what her traditional Mississippi family expected. How does she recover from family estrangement in the midst of her career as a psychotherapist? How does she find lasting love and a family of choice? From her last boyfriend suggesting she become a lesbian to coming out to the church ladies at her mama's funeral, these true stories will touch your heart, give you hope, and make you laugh out loud. Based on Elizabeth McCain's award-winning one-woman play, A Lesbian Belle Tells, this memoir provides story medicine for your soul. It is filled with Southern charm and drama, as well as triumph over tragedy, as only a lesbian belle can tell. Elizabeth McCain, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. As you know, of course, you and I met for another call like this for the Mississippi Book Festival. And so I'm glad we met each other there so we could do this and have more talks in the future.
Yeah, so am I, John. Thanks.
Yeah. So if you could begin by telling us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. Well, I live in the Washington, D.C. area in Tacoma Park, Maryland, with my wife, Marie, and our two spoiled dogs who are behaving very well right now. They're not barking. And for many years, I've been a spiritual counselor, an interfaith minister. I added professional storyteller about 10 years ago and solo performer because I have a little background in community theater.
Yeah.
And so I combine all of that because it's all about the power of story.
And I have to tell you that I'm just a little bit disappointed today because I thought when we would be talking that you'd be wearing your purple boa.
Oh, wait a minute. You know what?
There you go. Okay. That's, I love it. Okay. So for the listeners, when you see Elizabeth in a video talk or in one of her performances, you'll see the beautiful purple boa.
Yes.
It's also
a collection
in the book itself. So we have to let the listeners read the book to find out. So, tell us what led you to write this book.
Well, I've been thinking about writing a book for a while, but I really consider myself more of a spoken word artist. I'm an extrovert. However, I had written a one-woman show about 8 years ago and had been performing it, you know, pre-pandemic in the DC area and a little bit in the South, mostly in fringe theater festivals. And it took off. It started winning best solo show and it was thrilling. I mean, I was just doing it, you know, part-time on the side. And I had thought about turning it into a book. It's when people started to come up to me and say, have you thought about writing a book? These stories need to go out into the world, that I got serious about it. And I wanted to reflect on my life. I was then in my early to mid 50s and had experienced, you know, a lot of hard stuff, like most people, lots of loss and transition and kind of a bumpy coming out later in life kind of experience. And so I just wanted to reflect on that and sort of reframe the difficult stories and really inspire people, especially LGBTQ folks, to appreciate all of their stories, the fun ones and the difficult ones, because they all have wisdom in them, I think.
Yeah. And that kind of leads me to asking you about how you became fascinated with stories, just the power of stories in the first place.
Yeah, well, I think it all goes back to childhood, as everything usually does.
Yes, that's
I grew up, right? Yeah. I grew up, you know that, as a therapist, too.
We share that in common, too. That's right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I grew up in Northeast Mississippi in a tiny town called Okolona near Tupelo, and there was not a whole lot to do, but everybody gathered and told stories all the time. You know, my dad every day had these long lunches at Mildred's Cafe, and he'd get all the town gossip. He was quite an extrovert. He was a banker and a farmer. And then my mother and her two sisters bought a summer house up in the mountains of Tennessee near Sewanee in a town called Monteagle. And it was this big old Victorian house, and they named it Southern Comfort. And they would have these wild porch parties, and they'd all sit on the porch. And, you know, my Aunt Libba, she'd have scotch in one hand and a cigarette in the other. She said, darling girl, come sit beside me. I'll tell you stories your mama doesn't even know.
I love that.
So I just loved hanging out and hearing all these stories about my parents' childhood and their experiences when they were younger. And it was just a great way to connect and have a good time.
Yeah. So the stories have been with you a long time. And now you're taking them to tell people about your own experiences, but it seems like you're also trying to help the reader learn from the stories also.
Absolutely. I think storytelling, especially, I mean, whether we write them or whether we tell them, when we share them in community, there is this magic that happens, especially with our difficult stories, because we know that we have gotten through them for one thing, and we can feel a sense of empowerment and come to appreciate what I call the silver lining of difficult, like there are all these silver linings, I think, of this pandemic. You know, for many of us, we've reconnected with a lot of people. We've been able to slow down, some of us, if we're privileged enough to do that. And so I think storytelling is a, you know, it's a kind of psychotherapy and counseling and healing, really. I mean, that's what happens in a counseling room is a person, the client tells their story, right? And learns to, you know, over time, reframe those difficult stories to like, okay, here's what I've learned and here's how I want to live my life differently and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you say there's a part in your book where you talk about just how stories are so important and the therapeutic value. And I think that one of the examples you give is people in our community telling their coming out stories. That seems like such a common thing that people do with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been in my life, in the lesbian community, it's been like a rite of passage. I mean, even to this day, I came out in the 90s in my early 30s here in Washington, D.C. And I was fortunate enough to attend a coming out support group. And we would sit around and, you know, share our stories about how we were coming out to our family and friends. And still today, that's an important part of like a new friendship with a person, and certainly in promoting my book with the title, Like a Lesbian Bell Tells, I get to come out over and over and over again.
But it's true. You know, I've noticed in the gay community, in the queer community, that all of us together, I've noticed at parties or just when I meet people, we seem to talk about things like, of course, where do you work? How did you meet your partner or your spouse? You know, eventually get to the coming out story. It's just fascinating. And then stories about how did your family react to you coming out, which is a major theme in your book.
Yes, it is. And I think especially for those of us who are Southern, that can be a difficult thing because many of us came from very traditional, maybe religious families. Certainly I did, with parents who grew up Southern Baptist and then became Episcopalian. It was a rough journey, and it was a surprise when I came out to my family. You know, I kind of laugh now. I mean, it was painful back then, of course, but I sometimes have said, gosh, if I had just looked really butch, maybe it wouldn't have been so hard for them. I'm a lipstick lesbian, you know, I'm still a femme. So this never made sense to any of my family members.
You know, just like you did now, you have this way in the book of doing something that you call in the book Gothic comedy, that you talk about things that were really painful to you. And, you know, and the reader feels that pain, especially if they've experienced something similarly. But then you were able to turn it into this comic situation. So could you tell us about that and the power of, I guess, Gothic comedy?
Yeah, well, I grew up loving Southern literature, and I had this great teacher, Mrs. Susan Core, at this Episcopal boarding school who taught Southern literature. And I remember we read a lot of Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty short stories, and of course, Faulkner. And she introduced us to this Southern genre in literature known as Southern Gothic. And what I remember about that is that the themes in Southern Gothic, of course, this would be fiction. The themes had to do with oppression and alienation, dark humor. And then there was always some element of redemption. So I think that my stories have all of those elements. It's not fiction, of course. These are my true stories. And certainly I have written about the painful parts. And I think I have the gift somehow of, I'm not stand-up comic or anything, but I do have this gift of humor to bring in some levity to the really hard parts of my life. And I hope to inspire people because I think that humor can get us through a lot of grief. I think that grief and joy are sort of interconnected and two sides of the same coin, so that the larger my heart is to grieve, then the larger its capacity is to hold joy and laughter and play.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. I guess the whole idea that we grow from the challenges we have in our life.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that really comes through is, and you and I've talked about this in another conversation, but the paradoxes of Mississippi, the love and the hate for small towns. There's so many places. I just wondered if you could talk about that too.
Yes, I grew up with that sort of love-hate relationship. I remember as a teenager being very bored in my little town, although, I mean, I had friends and I loved my family and all of that. But I remember thinking of cities as these really exciting places that would offer theater and museums and just a richer kind of life. And so, you know, my parents were gave us the gift of offering us to leave to go to college. And I remember my dad said, "Well, I'll let you go anywhere. I'll pay for anywhere you go to college, as long as you don't go north of Virginia."
That's funny. I love how you do the voices. I'm hoping in a little while you can read one of your stories or a portion of one of your favorite stories to us.
Sure.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so I left a long time ago, went to an Episcopal boarding school, but in another tiny town in near Sewanee, Tennessee. And then I went to college, Randolph-Macon Women's College, and moved to Washington, D.C. in the late 80s. And certainly have loved being in this large metropolitan area with such rich, you know, rich things like diversity and theater and museums and all of that. And truth be told, as I get older, I sometimes miss the intimacy and connection that only happens in a small Southern town or small New England town. And so I was visiting Mississippi a lot right before the pandemic hit because I was finishing this book, and I felt like I needed to go back to the motherland, as I like to call it. to finish and to have some time to hang out and visit with people in my hometown and go to the cemetery and just kind of have a more leisurely healing visit. Because before that, I would only go for about 3 days and then I'd leave. And so I went for about 10 days and I reconnected with friends and, drove over to Oxford, Mississippi several times to my favorite bookstore over there and just really was coming to appreciate the South a little bit more. And I mean, I know it still has its challenges, certainly politically. But I found out that these pride festivals were happening in like Oxford and Starkville. And I thought, oh my gosh, change is coming to Mississippi. How exciting. So
who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
That's right.
Yeah. So it's been this paradox of, you know, struggling with some things and really embracing the rich Southern heritage that we have of storytelling and blues music and connection and community. And all of those are strong values that I still have.
Yeah. And that brings me to the question of what does it mean to be a Southerner? Because that's something else that comes through in your book.
Yeah. Well, for me, I identify strongly as a Southerner. I would say as a progressive Southerner. Because to me, being Southern is about embracing family and storytelling and connection. And there's something about the eccentricities, odd characters, unusual circumstances having to do with place and characters and conflict and what's not talked about, the secrets. And discovering the secrets and bringing that out into the open that are rich and complicated themes, I think, certainly in my life and in many LGBTQ Southerners' lives, I think.
Yeah, you know, there's sections in your book where you talk about Southern Way is not talking about the elephant in the room. And it seems like that this really came across in your book for me and something that I really got from people that I interviewed from my book, this idea that people in our community are reclaiming what it means to be Southern by saying it's not just the people who have these conservative values or some of the terrible things that have happened or that you have to be a certain type of person, but that we're Southerners too, because this is where we grew up.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think appreciating all of that and learning to bring things out into the open more, you know, and whether that's being out as a gay person or just being more truthful about things that are uncomfortable, being willing to engage in those kinds of conversations and still hang on to still maintain those relationships. I think that's part of being Southern as well.
Yeah, I found it very brave of you in several places in your book where you have these encounters. And as you said in the book, and you said this really well, that coming out can be like a daily experience. It can be like experience hour by hour, because you never know when you're going to have to tell someone about your relationship or something else is going on. But several places in the book where you're talking about what's going through your mind as you're having to decide, do I come out in this situation or not?
Yeah. Yeah, and usually I do. I mean, unless I feel like it's really dangerous, I am out, you know. But I can remember there were a few times, I went to a lot of writing workshops as I was writing this book, the first 2 years especially. And the workshops happened to be in Pennsylvania, which in that part of Pennsylvania, I don't think it's a real progressive area. And so, you know, occasionally, but I loved going and having the time to write. And I met some really interesting people. And I do remember one time I was sitting with a group of Dallas Christians. And I could just tell this was going to be interesting because everybody would say, you know, what's the title of your book? So I would just take a deep breath. And I decided, you know what? I'm just going to have fun with this, which is, again, I can rely on my humor to get me through kind of awkward situations. And I would say, well, have I got a title for y'all? Are you ready? Picture me in a purple boa on the stage, a lesbian Belle Telt. And usually everybody would just go into peals of laughter. And, you know, even the most conservative ones from Dallas. So I made some interesting connections. And again, in my hometown, when I went back and spent some time, there were a few days where I wasn't getting Wi-Fi. I was staying out in this cabin and friends and out in Monroe County. And I came into town for 3 or 4 days in a row and called a friend of mine who's the president of the bank where my father was president a long time ago. And they were kind enough to allow me to go into the board room, which had this huge table, and I spread my chapters out. And of course they were so friendly, you know, and the ladies would invite me to come have lunch down the hall in the kitchen where they were having chicken and dumplings. And I would go in, and of course my dad's been gone for a long time. And so the next generation of people have come to work in this bank, and many of them are not from Oklahoma. They're from other little towns around. So they didn't really know who I was. And they're like, oh, are you a consultant working at the bank? And I said, oh no, I grew up here and I'm finishing a book I'm writing. You know, so again, I would have to come out again. And
because everyone
and
always asks.
They would always ask, and I just have to, you know, get my energy up and just decide I'm going to make this a fun experience and we'll see. And mostly it has been very fun and very positive. I mean, a few people have, oh, well, that's not what I was expecting you to say. But, you know, that's an educational moment to go, you know, lesbians don't look one certain way. We come in all kinds of forms, and you know, that I think that was good for them to know that instead of because a lot of people stereotype, you know, you don't look like a lesbian. Well, what does a lesbian look like? Different looks.
And you had, that's another interesting part of the book where you talk about when you first came out, especially that it was difficult to know where to fit into this community, because you describe yourself, I'm quoting, as a lipstick lesbian, and you said that didn't seem to fit in a lot of circles. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I came out in 94 in DC, and at that time, I guess what was popular was that sort of either butch or androgynous look of like those big Doc Martin boots, you know, and polo shirts and cargo pants and that. You know, I just, that's not my look. And I remember the first time I walked in, into this lesbian dance. It was at this really nice place that is now the Trump Hotel, sadly, but it used to be a really nice place. Can't remember the name of it, but anyway, it was this dance place and a patio outside and a dance floor and this nice bar. And a friend of mine told me about this lesbian dance, and I was just coming out. I think it was only the second one I'd been to. And I said, well, what do lesbians wear? I don't know what to wear, Cindy. And she said, well, you're a femme, so just, you know, just be yourself and wear something kind of girly, you know, maybe a skirt or something. So I got all dolled up in this like silk mini skirt and black hose and flats of my little purse and makeup. And I go in and I look around into a sea of lesbians, and I think I called it the 1990s lesbian uniform, which was the polo shirt, Doc Martens, and
that's funny,
jeans, and women would come up to me and say, I remember this one kind of butch woman came up and said, what are you doing here? She was actually angry. She thought I was a straight woman spying on them. And I said, well, I'm a card-carrying member of this community, just like you are. I'm a lipstick lesbian, you know. And so that's what I noticed a lot in the 90s.
Yeah. And on the other hand, you had family members say to you that there's no way that you could possibly be a lesbian.
Correct. Yeah. My parents and my sister were just convinced that either I was rebelling, and this wasn't really who I was. And yeah, that was really hard. You know, because I wanted them to just honor my truth. And if only families and friends, when they find out someone is LGBTQ, if they could have more curiosity and compassion rather than judgment, mm-hmm. it would be a lot easier, I think.
Yeah. It's hard. That's something that you and I both hope is changing. I hope it's slowly changing, because
yeah,
such a difference. And both of us being therapists, we've heard so many stories of by people. Yeah. Another theme that comes through in your book is spirituality and your own spiritual journey.
Yeah. Well, it's been a rich one. I've always been a very spiritual person, and I suppose in a way I'm religious as well, in a progressive, inclusive kind of interfaith way.
Right.
I've never let go of that spiritual part of me, and I'm actually an ordained interfaith minister. I went to an interfaith seminary.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Was ordained in 2009 in Berkeley, California, and that was great. Beautiful. And yeah, so I've explored all kinds, Native American, shamanic, divine feminine, Buddhism. I'm still a member of an Episcopal church in Washington, D.C. that's very progressive, St. Mark's. So I just think, whatever is meaningful to people, whatever kind of path helps people discover something greater than themselves, some kind of higher power, I think is really helpful to have in life. That's gotten me through a lot of dark days.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And I thought that was an important part of your book, because so many people in our community, had a really, their spirituality was something that was really a strength for them. And then when they came out and they were rejected by a religion or a spiritual community, they lost that. It's nice to read stories of people like you who've shared your experiences of growing and finding something that really fits you and is a source of strength for you.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I help clients do that as well, to find their own authentic spiritual path. Mm-hmm. I think is really important, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to believe in a religious being. Mm-hmm. It can mean creative higher power. For a while we went to a Unitarian church, and so I read a lot about the importance of people who were humanists and atheists, and including all of those folks in a mm-hmm. spiritual community is important. Although in Mississippi, I think it's still very Christian.
It is. But I like what you're saying, the focus on what does that bring meaning to someone's life.
Yeah.
This is probably a question I should have asked early in the interview, but it's kind of fun to kind of jump around like we're doing. So
yeah.
You mix in so well this painful periods with the comedy, and you even have a tongue-in-cheek title when you say a lesbian belle tells. So tell us about what a lesbian belle is.
Oh, right. Well, years ago, I put an ad in, I can't remember if I was dating men or women at that point. I think maybe one of each. So there used to be a Washingtonian magazine here in the uh-huh. D.C. area, but way before online dating. I'm dating myself. This is back in the early 90s, I guess. And I put an, and you had to have a title for your ad. And mine said, the first one said, "Your mama would love me."
I love that. That's funny.
You know, girl next door kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
And the next one, actually, a friend of mine who was a straight man helped me with this title. He suggested, and at this point, I was definitely dating women. I remember that. I wasn't dating this guy. We were friends from a spiritual community. He was a great guy, John. And he suggested that my title should be "For Whom the Bell Tolls."
That's good.
That in. And then years down the road, I wrote this one woman show, and I was working with a director who was helping me, and we were both trying to come up with a really catchy title. She was telling me how important it is to have a great, strong title. And suddenly one day it came to me, A Lesbian Bell Tells, because it's storytelling. I love the paradox, the juxtaposition there of two very different images, lesbian and Bell. And I think of Bell, and not, I know that word is loaded and it can bring up images of, you know, antebellum world of slavery and
Scarlett O'Hara. Yeah.
Scarlett O'Hara type stuff. That's not what I mean by Bell. It's more of the playful Southern part of me that still likes to have my shoes and my purse match and wear lipstick and, you know,
kind of prissy, right?
Well, I would prefer to use the word colorful and color coordinated.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, and still I'm a lesbian. I'm an out lesbian. I'm a feminist. I'm progressive. Like it's sort of my version of intersectionality, I guess, to be
the
Southern lesbian, spiritual, kind of edgy, all of that mixed together is sort of like embracing all parts of myself. So that's how I think of it.
Well, I love that you use the word intersectionality, because it really goes back to that question of what it means to be Southern. And I think it comes across for me so strongly in your book about how you're reclaiming what it means to be Southern.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's really important to reclaim parts of ourselves, especially, you know, if we didn't appreciate that. Like there was a part of me in the past that I felt almost embarrassed or ashamed to be from Mississippi because of the horrific racism and homophobia that still exists. You know, I still have moments of sort of cringing. And so it's also important, though, for me to let people know that there is another side of Mississippi and the rest of the Deep South, that there are progressive people there trying to change things for the better.
Yeah, I think so. And I guess when I say reclaiming Southern identity, I think about especially some of the politicians out of Mississippi that are in the news.
Yeah.
Saying things that are you just cringe when you hear it, and you're thinking, That's not all the people I know who are Mississippians or who are Southerners. There's a lot of people like Elizabeth who are really very progressive and really trying to reclaim the parts that are good, the connectivity with other people and the love and things like that.
Absolutely. And especially in the university towns in Mississippi. I mean, let me tell you, during this pandemic, I have been so fortunate to connect with so many great people. Professors at Mississippi State and Delta State and people in Jackson. I have just really enjoyed and some of these people are straight as well, are very good allies. And I've actually, fingers crossed, my show is booked and a storytelling workshop at State in Starkville in March. And also at Delta State. And I hope to get it booked at other places down there too, because there are still a lot of really good progressive people working hard down there for positive change.
There really are. Yeah. And I can't wait to see you come down here. I'll be at the show.
Oh, thank you, John. That'd be great.
Yeah. So I wondered if you had one of your favorite stories in the book that you'd be willing to share with readers or listeners here to give them a sense of what it's like when they read your book.
Sure. I think I'd like to read chapter 10, A Southern Funeral to Die For, about going to my mother's funeral.
That's a great story. I love that.
Thanks. Yeah. Mama's death marked a new chapter in my life. A few days after she died in Boston, Marie and I flew down to Mississippi for her funeral. It was a traditional Episcopal funeral in my childhood church, Grace Episcopal, I remember it was a quiet service with prayers from the Book of Common Prayer and comforting hymns such as Amazing Grace, How Great Thou Art, and Jerusalem, My Happy Home. After the burial, we went back to my childhood home on Monroe Avenue for the Celebration of Life party, because y'all, Southern funerals are to die for. That's when the healing begins. All that connecting and remembering and sharing stories for hours with friends and family. Let's face it, sometimes our friends are more fun than our family members. There are peals of laughter and soft, teary eyes. Joy and sadness held in a container of love. Sharing heartwarming stories and eating comfort food, these rituals begin to heal grief. And oh, the food. All that delicious Southern funeral food, like melt-in-your-mouth pot roast, crispy fried chicken, cooked-to-death casseroles, like asparagus with melted Velveeta cheese on top, and homemade biscuits with ham. And the desserts, Sakatumi pound cake, moist chocolate cake, and apple pie. Not exactly healthy, but to Southerners, this kind of food was a staple of our lives growing up, before gluten-free was a thing. There's an amazing book called Being Dead is No Excuse, the official Southern Lady's Guide to Hosting the Perfect Southern Funeral. There are scrumptious recipes in that book. Marie and I walked into the house and entered the living room. There were lots of proper church ladies in their black funeral dresses standing around. Everyone stared at us when we walked into the room. My sister, Marguerite, looked uncomfortable, jumped up and said, "Everyone, this is Marie, our family friend." And I thought to myself, oh, hell no, I am not going to be closeted. So I took a deep breath and said, "No, Marie is my partner, not a family friend." My sister shot me an angry look. Then there was an awkward silence. Then at the perfect moment, Mama's best friend and sorority sister, Shirley, sauntered in. She looked stunning as a 77-year-old Southern lady wearing her black and white tweed suit with pearls, burgundy lipstick, and her beautiful silver helmet of thick hair that made her aquamarine eyes pop. Wearing her shiny black pumps and black hose, Shirley was still one classy Southern lady. I'd known Shirley my whole life and loved her. She and Mama were tri-deltas at Ole Miss. That's Delta, Delta, Delta. Can I help you, help you, help you? Sorority, class of 1946. I've always loved Shirley because she was the opposite of Mama. She was extroverted, fun, outrageous, and curious, bordering on nosy in a warm way. While Mama was introverted, serious, private, and reserved, Shirley had no filter. She said what she thought and felt. Shirley rushed over to me and gave me a Mama Bear hug. God, how I've missed those squeezy tight hugs from older Southern ladies. "Oh, Elizabeth, darling girl, I'm so sorry we lost your Mama. She was my best friend." "Well, I hear you brought your partner, and I don't guess you mean business partner, do you, darling?" Oh, leave it to Shirley for a fabulous icebreaker at a Southern funeral. Shirley, Marie, and I laughed nervously while everyone else in the room stared at us. "Hello, dear Shirley. I'm so glad you're here. This is Marie, my partner. We've been together for 2 years. Shirley smiled, showing her perfectly white teeth, which had to be dentures. Her voice went up an octave like she was excited and uncomfortable. "Oh, well, hello, Marie. I'm so glad to meet you, honey." Shirley looked Marie over from head to toe in that sizing you up look that older coiffed Southern ladies do so well. "Marie, I'm so glad you and Elizabeth don't wear those big old manish shoes." Little did Shirley know I had forbidden Marie from wearing her big comfortable lesbian shoes to Mama's funeral. "Elizabeth, darling, let's go in the kitchen. I have some questions I want to ask you." I felt excited and a bit nervous as we made our way back to the kitchen. "Honey, did your Mama know?" "Yes, Shirley, Mama knew that I'm a lesbian." "Well, did she ever meet Marie?" "No, she refused to meet her. My siblings, Jim and Marguerite, only met Marie a few days ago at the hospital in Boston. No one in my family's accepted me except for a few cousins and my aunts. It's been a painful journey for me. I never dreamed that Mama would reject me for so long.
Well, I'm so sorry, Elizabeth. Your mama was so religious ever since your brother went off the deep end growing and smoking all that marijuana at Ole Miss back in 65. When we Tri-Delta gals traveled together, by the way, we called ourselves the Golden Girls, your mama would bring the Bible and our friend Annell would bring the bourbon. Those were wild trips. We call those trips our B&Bs. Oh, Shirley, I wish I'd been with y'all on those trips. She grinned and continued, but listen, darling, your mother, we called her by her maiden name, Cooper. Well, about 8 years ago, Cooper stopped talking about you. All of us Golden Girls thought that was the oddest thing because you were her midlife baby and she always talked about you. We thought you had cancer or something. Finally, we heard through the Mississippi gossip grapevine about your situation. Oh, that I'm a lesbian. Well, what'd you think, Shirley? Well, I was shocked because you're a pretty girl and I knew you had boyfriends, but secretly, honey, I was kind of thrilled because I've never known any real live lesbians. And I wondered if she knew some dead lesbians. Well, Shirley, I'm glad you're kind of excited about it. We walked back into the living room and Shirley stared at Marie and then stared back at me. She walked over to Marie like she was determined. I held my breath. Marie, sugar, I sure do love you, a Southern girl from North Carolina. Thank the Lord Elizabeth didn't end up with a Yankee. That would be more shocking than being gay. We laughed heartily, and Shirley continued to amaze me when she said, I want y'all to come down and visit me in the Delta this spring down in Indianola. There's nothing like losing your mother, honey. You know, Cooper and I shared the same birthday, April 16th, 1925. And Marie, I want to get to know you. Y'all come for Easter, Elizabeth. That'll be a hard time for you. We'll share our sadness and our stories about your mama. I was thrilled and amazed that Shirley was embracing us.
I love that story. It's beautiful. Yeah.
And Thank you.
Could see your voice also, which I guess they will see in the one woman show, because if you could see, in addition to doing the voices, she shows these expressions in her face so that you there's a different person talking to you. So.
Oh, right. I do lots of characters in my show. Yeah. It's a lot.
Oh, you're really
fun.
Good. You have a way of telling a story. Very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. What would you like the listeners to, or anyone who reads your book, to take away from your book?
Well, I hope that my book inspires people to really think about their own stories, especially their stories of loss, because I think during this pandemic, we've had so much loss. And if we can kind of appreciate our stories and reframe them, I think we can all connect on a deeper level and we can heal and feel more empowered instead of feeling like a victim. And I really want people to know that, you know, we're just all connected. We're not really alone, even though sometimes we might feel kind of isolated. If people will just take a little risk and, like I like to say, pick up the phone, you know, stop all this texting and hear other human voices. That's really important for us to do, to feel connected, to have the positive endorphins released in the brain. Yeah, there's nothing like a good conversation. I mean, there's nothing like one in person, of course, first of all. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us have not been able to be in groups very much for the past year and a half. Some this summer, I think, for those of us who were fully vaccinated, we started to see people and get out a little bit, but we're still very cautious. And yet I'm still amazed at, you know, in person is just so much better than Zoom and texting and social media and all that. I really want people to embrace this connection. Through sharing stories and to have more courage to be vulnerable and tell some of the difficult stories and realize that we're all connected.
And I imagine that through your book, you give many people permission to do that. So I think it's a great service you're doing.
Thank you. I hope so. And the other thing that I'm excited to start doing in the spring, I'm going to be traveling a lot, actually, I think in the South and in other places too, is that I want to offer, in addition to performing like at universities and big theaters, I also do smaller events like performing it at what I call a house concert. Mm-hmm. So I'll do the pure storytelling version without all the tech and the music and all that, which is actually easier to do. Yeah. And it's more intimate to a group of 20, 30, 40 people, and then have like a weekend event. And I do storytelling workshops as well. Oh. And I teach people how to craft a meaningful, poignant story. And then at the end of the weekend, for those who are interested, we'll have a little show and let people perform and invite some friends. And again, that's so great for connecting and community building and healing and just feeling grateful and joyful about being together again.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I look forward to seeing that.
Thank you.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on our podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, John. Thanks so much for having me. And by the way, I enjoyed reading your book as well. All those interviews with those couples, that was amazing. You must have had a great time doing that and getting those stories.
Oh, I did. Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. Yeah. And to our listeners, if you are interested in reading A Lesbian Belle Tells by Elizabeth McKay, please click on the highlighted title of the book in the description included with this podcast. And join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South on the New Books Network.